The topic for today is taken from the Parashas HaShavua, footnote, I should say, Maror Mokom number one, cited in its entirety, the Parashah of Gerushin, which is found in this week's Parashah, Parashas Kiseitse. And the operative phrase for our purpose is the Kosev La Sefer Krisus V'Nosan B'Yod of Shilchami Beiso. Chachamim explained to us in the Masechta Gittin that in order for a Jewish divorce, a get, to be effective, it has to be issued willingly by the husband. This, of course, can lead to tremendous problems in a situation in which the husband refuses to grant such a get to a woman. By Torah law, a woman can be divorced against her will. Rabbeinu Gershom, this is just background information, Rabbeinu Gershom said that can no longer be done. A man can no longer divorce his wife against her will under ban of a cherim. If he does so, he's in cherim, he's in excommunication. Similarly, Rabbeinu Gershom disallowed bigamy, polygamy. By Torah law, a man can have more than one wife. Rabbeinu Gershom disallowed that. So by the combination of these two cherims, if you will, Rabbeinu Gershom was trying to use a modern phrase to more or less level the playing field, which means now they're both stuck in the marriage. He can't get out without her assent. She can't get out without his assent. He cannot marry with someone else. She can't marry someone else. So it's more or less a level playing field. I say more or less because clearly since Rabbeinu Gershom is a later enactment in the time of the Gaonim, it's 1,000 years old, it wasn't accepted in all parts of the people of Israel. Some Sephardic communities don't accept it. And Rabbeinu Gershom, because he didn't want to make problems where they are, where they don't belong, had a loophole. The loophole is what's called a heter meir rabbanim. If you have 100 rabbis to sign on that a woman is to be not able to receive a get, or doesn't want to receive a get, and she really should be receiving the get, in some limited cases it could be a heter meir rabbanim, in which case the man deposits a get with the bezdin and is told you can marry a second wife. And if the woman will either recover from an illness or recover from her rebelliousness, as it's called, and decide to take the get, it will be there waiting for her. I have to tell you, this is as an aside, that unfortunately, there are those who have abused the Heter Meir Rabbanim instrument. In certain cases, issuing it when it didn't belong, and even more egregious cases, issuing a Heter Meir Rabbanim without depositing to get an escrow for the woman to pick it up. So therefore the man can have his cake and eat it too. He takes a second wife, and when his first wife wants, "Oh, give me the get." "Oh, not until you satisfy such and such a condition." But Moshe screams about this last outrageous practice in the beginning of his last Chelek of Evan Ezer, and it certainly should not be done. Where I come from, we're very loath to become involved in the Heter Meir Rabbanim in general, because it's so hard to know, you know, whether it's warranted or not warranted. I'm not here to cast aspersions. However, in the case of a woman who is extraordinarily incapacitated, mentally incapacitated, and is simply unable to function, in that kind of a case, it's not really an adversarial kind of a thing. It's simply to help the man get out of his impossible situation. It's called nishtates as opposed to moredes. So then the rabbanim that I've dealt with have had a much more charitable view of Heter Meir Rabbanim. Now he's trying to hurt his wife. She's unfortunately just tragically been incapacitated. We're dealing with such a case presently, as a matter of fact, in our bezin. In any event, back to the topic at hand. So we have a situation in which bottom line is, for most situations, you cannot dissolve this quote-unquote partnership without the consent of both parties. He has to agree to give the get, and practically speaking, in almost all cases, she has to agree to receive the get. So what happens in such situations? What do you do if one party refuses? What do you do? So you'll say, this is too bad. They both got into this relationship. They knew what it was all about. They knew that it's not dissolvable without the consent of both parties. So it becomes like anything in some of the businesses that you're involved in, negotiations. Right? It'll be a partnership and you want to dissolve it. So Do I want out more? Do you want out more? Whoever wants out more has to sweeten the pot for the other party, that they should agree to want out. And that's what happens in many cases. Of course, here we're not discussing finance, we're discussing personal freedom, if you will, ability to build your life and to remarry, etc., etc. So it gets much more emotional and much more problematic. The Chachamim had disputes over many years about the following concept. The rabbis have taught us it is true that a man has to give the get of his own volition, but there can be limited cases in which we say, Kofin oso achi yomar rotzani. We force you until you say yes. This kind of a yes seems to be almost meaningless to us. It's a yes under a gun. But there are certain limited cases in which this kind of compulsion is warranted, is acceptable, based upon the Mishnayos and the Gemaras, and the Masechta Gittin, the Masechta Ksubis, based upon, of course, the proper Pesach of a Bezdin, under the unusual circumstances. These circumstances almost don't exist. And the reason for that is that there's so many disputes among the Chachmei Yisrael over the generations. We don't want to get involved in a possibility of a forced get because the stakes are simply too high. In case the get is what we call the get me'usa, it's a forced get which is not warranted. Chas v'shalom, if it's an illegitimate get, the second marriage is adultery, the children are under retained of mamzeres, which is also this week's parasha. So we try to avoid these things. Rabbeinu Tam was the one who had a strict position in this matter. The Rambam said that if a woman says about her husband, Moy Solai, he's disgusting to me, he's a grounds for forcing the husband to divorce his wife. So it's a Rambam. And there have been calls recently to follow the Rambam. Why not? The Rambam was a great Talmud Chacham. Let's follow the Rambam. The reality is that in the broader community it's not going to happen for a number of reasons. Number one, the Shulchan Aruch himself, Sfardic Psak, rejects the Rambam. It was too bold a position for Rabbi Yosef Kara to accept. So even he didn't accept it. Certainly the Ramah, the Ashkenazim, does not accept this Rambam. It's hard to go out on a limb based upon the Rambam when it's been rejected by almost all the subsequent Rishonim and Achronim. Although there are some who mention the Rambam as a sniff, as a possibility in certain difficult cases. So, the same Rabbi Natan, when he prohibited what we call kfiya, compulsion, in a case in which the woman said, Moy Salai, he's disgusting unto me, had to have some kind of a device. The women shouldn't be held agunas. What was his device? Harchokos to Rabbeinu Tam. Harchokos to Rabbeinu Tam means that although we're not permitted to hit someone, and I include in the illicit means of compulsion a number of other things. We may not hit someone. We may not excommunicate someone. We may not incarcerate someone. Nor may we take someone's money, which is we have no right to take, in order to compel him to give a get. Any of those, and certain others as well, would be considered illicit forms of compulsion and would place the get under a serious cloud. Nonetheless, at Rabbeinu Tam, we're not permitted to take from this individual, take his freedom, take his money, take his well-being by hitting him, etc., etc. But we're not required to give him either. In the normal course of interpersonal matters, there's always a giving and a taking. We're permitted to have what we call harchokos to Rabbeinu Tam. Stay away from this person, says Rabbeinu Tam, unless and until he gives his wife a get, as the Bezdin declares he's required to do so. If he doesn't give the get, we're permitted, and perhaps even encouraged in certain limited circumstances, to implore these harchokos, a kind of a social sanction, a social pressure on him, to want to give the get. Of course, these kinds of social incentives will only work for an individual who is desirous of remaining within the community. Someone decides to just opt out of the community, to opt out of the Torah community or the particular community, there's not much you can do about it. That's unfortunate, but that's the reality of today's world. What's in a sense even more unfortunate is that the reality is that often the rabbinic leadership cannot get together on the implementation of these harchokas. So the people who really should give a get, as even the psak of a bezna should give a get, or the local rabbanon should give a get, and then the guy just goes from one shul to the other, to the other, to the other, even if someone's in the same community, until he finds somewhere where he'll have a safe haven, and he can live his life until 120 years, leaving his wife an aguna, and being an upstanding member of his particular synagogue context. So this, I believe, is something which is wrong, and I believe that the community should do its best to rise up and prevent it from happening. This, of course, is on the one hand, an obligation on the men, not to establish what we call a men's club, a boys' club, but to befriend such a person as heretofore, even though the bezin says he's supposed to give his wife a get. And of course, women have also been known to take initiatives in this regard. There's a celebrated case in which the woman went on a mikveh strike. It happened in Toronto. They went on the mikveh strike. There was a woman who was being held in aguna, and nothing would work. Nothing could move him. Nothing. The rabbanim couldn't move him. The balabatim couldn't move him. Nothing. So she appealed to her women friends. Help me out. So all the women decided in this community, we're not going to the mikveh. Period. That's it. No mikveh. The get was given pretty quickly. I believe that get was a kosher get, even though there was a certain, In any event, so it was kosher. I don't think this guy beat the guy up. If they would have beat him up, then it would have been no matter what the reason they beat him up, it would be a problem with the get. They, I guess, convinced him that you're destroying the shalom bias, and the whole, you have to give it. So the question is therefore what to do. What to do? It's a problem. It's an old problem. There have always been men who didn't want to give their wives gittin. But as I said before, there was a certain amount of social pressure which could be brought to bear, whether through the harfaklas of Rabbeinu Tam or other devices. The rabbanim had a certain sway. You couldn't run from shul to shul to shul in those years. If you lived in Prague, then know the Behuda was your rav. No matter where, you couldn't hide from the Behuda and then some shtibul. You just couldn't do it. He was the rav of the entire city of Prague. And if he said give a get and you didn't, you were out of favor, and you lived as a social outcast. This is enough to convince most people to give a get. Then, of course, you had perhaps even more persuasive rabbanim, such as Rabbi Kivega. Kivega, the story is told, was a case in his town where the guy was supposed to give a get and didn't do it. He called him into his study and said, "My dear friend, let's learn the Mishnah and Kiddushin together." Where it says in the first mission of Beis, the kona as atzma beget uvemisa sabal, that a woman can become free of her husband either through a get or through the death of a husband. What do you think? So the guy was as upon him, and he said, "I'm sorry, Rabbi, I'm not giving her a get." The story is told. But the guy walked out of the Rabbi Kivega's house in the study. There were steps in front of the thing. As soon as he walked out the door, he had a massive, I don't know what he had, fell down the steps and he died. Now, I want to claim, if a second husband would be presented with that claim and he gave the get, it might be a get puzzle. Rabbi Kivega basically gave him a death threat. So there was certain power that the rabbinate had in years gone by. You couldn't run from place to place. Today, you can unfortunately run from shtiebel to shtiebel, and if you don't like that, so you can opt out and become a non-Orthodox Jew or an unaffiliated Jew. Couldn't do that in Europe. Europe, they had to belong to a community. If you didn't want to be Jewish, you had to become a Christian. Not most Jews didn't want to become Christians. I mean, even if they were not such great guys, they were Magnumis and the Shosea, but to become a Christian, that was a little bit too much for them. So they were sort of stuck in the Jewish community, and the Jewish had governmental power behind them. It was the problems existed, but there were many fewer. Let's also remember, there were many fewer divorces. Divorce, in my memory, divorce was something which was a very rare occurrence. Very rare. I've said this before, that my family moved into Kew Garden Hills, a nice Jewish community. We moved there, it was not almost 50 years ago. I was a little child before Bar Mitzvah. And I remember there was whispers that somewhere in the front of the shul there was a man who was actually divorced. It was like, Today, I don't have to tell you what's happened in the last 50 years in terms of the explosion of these. But we're not going into that right now. So obviously, if there are more cases, there are going to be more problematic cases, just by definition. So what do you do about it? You know, so most of us just wring our hands and say it's a shame. It's a shame that the man is not being able to move on with his life because his wife refuses to take the get. Or more commonly, the shame is that the man refuses to give the get. As a case, it's a shame because once the marriage is in effect dead and then no reconciliation is possible, the proper thing to do is to move on with life, end the marriage, and then start all over again. Why should they be held down to each other? Of course, the problem is, what do you do about it? It's really hard. It's not an easy nut to crack, obviously. So, my initial involvement in this difficult parsha, if I may use the expression, difficult parsha, goes back to when I had my first crisis in my own shul. And that's how you learn from the crisis. I had a case in the shul of a very wonderful man, a wonderful woman. We were getting along. I was trying to help them out. At the end, it came that she wanted out, and he said, "Well, I need this and this." Otherwise, he used the word aguna. So when I heard the word aguna, I said to myself, "This can't be." So I said, "Listen, knowing what I know about the case, you really should give your wife a get if she asks for it." So he did what most balabatim do. He went to the other rabbanim. To the tremendous credit of the other rabbanim in town, they're still here. Same two rabbanim are still, Baruch Hashem, al mamlachtam. The two other rabbanim, based on the man's, they only heard it from the man. They said, "I'm sorry, but we think based on your story," he was a very honest man, very honest man, "you have to give your wife a get." He says, "You have to do it." But he refused. And he wanted this, and he went to go into court. Da 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 da. So we told him in a nice way, and we don't want to be responsible for this kind of situation where you use the word aguna, the A word. We cannot be part of it. So please don't come to our shuls until the situation is resolved. We didn't want to hurt you. He's a good fellow, but we just didn't want it. That we should, you know, if we do nothing, so it's a kind of a shtika code. We didn't want it. It's a little private place on down the block where he went. We want him to have a place to go. He's a fine Jew, and it went its way through court. This case for half a year, and finally, the judge was a very smart Jewish woman, someone coached her well. And I believe she said to the man as follows: "Listen, I'm dividing your assets 50-50. Okay? Equal distribution, 50-50. But I know your wife wants a get. If you give your wife a get, I'll give you, I think she said, an extra 5%. Hey, that's an incentive. But it was couched in a proper phraseology of an incentive as opposed to a penalty. If she would say, "I'll only give you 45% if you don't give the get," that would be a serious halachic problem. That's part of the problem of the get law. The second get law runs into those kinds of problems, which we don't have time to go into today. But the get was given. He came to our shul the following Shabbos, and I instructed the gabbai, "You must give this man shlishi." So the gabbai asked me, same gabbai as he said, "There's a rabbi, I don't understand. For 6 months, he was persona non grata, and I shlishi?" I said, "Absolutely. He's a wonderful man. We all love him. Just that he wasn't giving his wife a get. So he gave his wife a get. I demand he gets shlishi." Good gabbai gave him shlishi. After the aliyah, I went up and I shook his hand in front of the whole shul. "No one should think I never anything against the person. I still don't. Just that we took a more active position, which we were able to do, and it had some measure of an effect because the rabbanim stood together." That year, that same year, it was 1990, the yeshiva was learning Gittin. I said to my talmidim after Pesach, "No more lumdus, let's learn the sugya. Let's learn the sugya and figure out something. Maybe we can make some kind of a contribution." So, the last sugya Masechta Gittin about get me'usa, when you may force a get, not force a get, what do you do, or this way, that way, the other way. And at the time, there were certain suggestions that were out there, but none of the suggestions had ever really been implemented on a wide scale. And those that were implemented had certain problems. I'm going to give you a very brief summary of some of those suggestions that have been made. And we'll maybe mention a few that haven't made since, and what some of the issues are concerning them. One suggestion, a very good suggestion, is that, wait a minute, just enforce the ksuba. In the ksuba, a man promises, undertakes, to give his wife support his wife. Kirchus given you died. You've ever all been at weddings recently. That's what it says. I will support you. Kirchus given you died. Or if it was translated into English, notarize it, or someone make it and have the husband sign it. And listen, it says he has to support his wife as long as they're Jewishly married. This itself should provide an incentive to a man to give a get, because otherwise it's going to cost the money out of pocket every single day that they're married. Makes a lot of sense. A very good suggestion. Excellent. Only one little problem. That is source number six. Source number six says, "Ha'isha sheyotzem ibeis bala v'hochol abayas acher." So, skipping a line just to get to the main point. "Imhoisa l'ktata imbala v'lo mister lo imo." They cannot live together. So it depends. If it's the man's fault, he has to pay her for her mezonos, for her support. If it's her fault, so the problem is, if the couple separates, so he will always claim that it's her fault. And if it's her fault, he need not pay her support. And what's the first rule of dini mamonos of monetary matters? Hamotzi mechavero, all of a riot. There you go. So she has to prove, right, that it's not her fault. Till that happens, she gets to turn gray. So in principle, it's a very good suggestion. But in real life, I don't believe that it's that effective. So that's, the ksuba itself, again, is a wonderful instrument, but I don't think it's going to work in so many of these kinds of cases. That's the problem. Now, Rav Moshe, Zechuto Livracha, was asked a question by Rabbi Per Shalita, Rashiva Vishiva Farakaway. Is it okay to require a couple to sign what he called a shtare birurin? A shtare birurin means simply a document of arbitration. That the couple agrees before they're married, in case there's a problem, they agree to arbitrate before a particular best. And Rabbi Per, in his question, was bothered by the fact that in his community there were too many cases where the couple broke up and there was a tremendous battle which bezdin to go to, and that battle was could go on for years, and some of them ended up going to court because they couldn't agree on a bezdin. All terrible results. At least if they agree in advance to go to a particular bezdin and it's legally binding, this kind of document, it can at least solve some of the issues. Rav Moshe writes it's permissible. It's printed in a tshuva. It's one of those funny tshuvas. There are three versions of the same tshuva. And the bigger Igros Moshe, and the small Igros Moshe, and there's the typescript that I have with manuscript correction by Rav Moshe. This is one of those. There's nothing really substantive about the distinctions. It's just subtleties. Is it a good idea? Should do it only when it's necessary? Should do it all the time? Those are subtleties. But of course, Rav Moshe assumes that it's a permissible in some cases, it's a good idea to do it. And Rabbi Per does it to this day. And I assume it's effective up to a point. It should at least come to a bezdin. Of course, the problem will come. They'll come to a bezdin. The bezdin will say, you have to give it again. It'll say, do me something. I'm not going to do it. So then what? So the bezdin can't do anything. I say, you're a bad guy. Okay. But then he says, so I'm a bad guy. But I'm not going to give her a get. So she can, again, be an aguna forever. So it's a partial solution, because often the hardest problem is getting the man to come to bezdin in the first place. He doesn't want to come. This can sort of compel him. Again, it's hard to know whether the court's going to compel his appearance based upon this piece of paper, but maybe it would. All right. So, one of the distinguished members of the New York rabbinate, sensing this problem, added a line into his version of the prenuptial agreement, and I read it to you from the original. It's printed in a book called The Rabbinate as Calling and Vocation. Some of you may have that book. Quote, "In the event of any breach of this contract, the injured party shall be entitled to injunctive or mandatory relief directing specific performance of the obligations included herein." Those who are either lawyers or know a little bit about these things know specific performance, you must do something. And if you don't do it, it's injunctive or mandatory relief. Who knows what that means? Yeah, it means contempt of court. And who knows what that means? ultimately? Jail. So it's a big problem, because jail is one of the things we mentioned before you're not permitted to do, to in effect coerce or convince someone to give a get. That is a serious problem. People don't fully realize, you know, it doesn't say it, just it says it's fancy legalese, but it really means jail. And that's a problem. It's a serious problem.
In Eretz,
they put people in jail only in situations in which they say it's subject to kfir, so that were not for the democracy that Eretz Yisrael is, they'd beat the guy up. That they don't allow. So the Raya put him in jail, but only in the limited, very limited cases in which according to halacha you may actually, strictly speaking, kofan also b'shotim with whips. They don't do that. They put him in jail. Unfortunately, there's some people who are languishing in jail, and the wives are languishing as agunas. Unfortunately, it's a very sad thing. Sad. In America, we don't have that power in any event, clearly. So therefore, the only real possibility, if you one wants to stay within the halachic realm of a full marriage and a proper divorce, would be what we call some kind of a prenuptial agreement that a man should support his wife, notwithstanding the fact that she's no longer living with him, and he can no longer claim that it's her fault and he's exempt. But before going into the details of that, I want to mention a few other more avant-garde or radical suggestions that have been utilized to somehow alleviate the guna problem, which I want to just briefly mention and explain why I just said that it's no good. Some said, let's do what we call Kiddushin al Tanai. Kiddushin al Tanai, we will marry on a condition. The condition is that if the woman, let's say for argument's sake, is successful in obtaining a civil divorce, which she can always obtain in this country, at that point in time, the marriage is null and void, retroactively. Sounds quite far-reaching, quite far-reaching. Yet, there is a case in which the Ramah, no less an authority than the Ramah, mentioned such a possibility. It has to do with source number two. Source number two, again, this week's parasha. Source number two. Ki yeshu achim yachtov, umeis echad mehem ubeinein lo, lo siya eshes ameis achutzo liishzor. This is the violation of a woman who has a brother. She died, her husband died childless, and there's a brother. You have to have what we call yibama chalitza. Then there were terrible cases of brothers who would not undergo the chalitza process. Sometimes because they were spiteful, sometimes because they were extortionists, and sometimes because they simply belonged to other religions. They just opted out. They're not going to get involved in any Jewish ceremonies anymore. There were women who were simply held hostage in these kinds of circumstances. Now, there were cases in which at the moment that the woman married her husband, she already knew he had a brother who, for one of many reasons, would be a major problem in the case of a chalitza. She, of course, hoped to have children, but she was aware of the possibility that there are couples where there is no or no children. So they would get have a kiddushin al tanai. What was the condition? In case the couple is childless, then the kiddushin will be nullified retroactively upon the death of the husband. Quoted in Ramah, the sources of Marie Bruna. And there were those who wanted to capitalize on this Ramah and apply it across the board. If there'll be a civil divorce, so then the marriage is nullified retroactively. Sounds good. But most poskim didn't like it. An entire sefer was written in 1930 in Europe. It was called Ein Tanai B'Nisuin. There can be no condition and when it comes to Nisuin. The Nisuin, of course, is the second stage of marriage. Kiddushin, there can be a condition. That's a Mishnayos and Masechta Kiddushin. That's betrothal. But full marriage cannot be conditional. For a variety of reasons. A recent scholar wrote a book in the 60s, which he entitled, I think, Yesh Tanai B'Nisuin. But that was only one, and the consensus view of the Gedolei Yisrael was Ein Tanai B'Nisuin. What about the Marie Bruna? That's a unique case for a variety of reasons. Number one, that condition could never come about in the husband's lifetime. So therefore, perhaps since it's not going to happen in his lifetime, so he's willing to accept this kind of a condition. As opposed to a case in which it might come about in his lifetime, then we have a klal, ein adam osa bilas o bilas nus, and he's going to override the condition when he lives with his wife, because he can't stand the fact that she's going to walk out on him one day without a get, and he's alive, and he won't be able to bear to witness to it. But as opposed to a case in which he's going to be dead, that's a different story. Much more to be said, I'm just being brief. There's another suggestion that's been recently made, and that is, well, just don't get married in the first place. Well, that's great, but that's not allowed. That's a pasuk. That's a pasuk in this week's parsha, which should have been source 3, but obviously it's a typo. It says in this week's parsha, Lo siya kadesha b'nos Yisrael, there cannot be a physical relationship without marriage. It's called pilegesh. According to the Rambam, a pilegesh is an isur min haTorah. It's a Torah prohibition. So it just doesn't work. So there are those who say, well, they found a shita that says pilegesh is permissible. It's true. There are certain limited shitas to that effect. So let's just recommend that. There was an infamous group in Brooklyn. What do they call themselves? The Shalom Bias organization, some kind of wild name. Unfortunately, it made its way all the way into the Washington Post, unfortunately, with a Chil Hashem in a big time, by having a Pilegesh, and I was a concubine, as it's called. It was really, we did not look good at all in this, it really looked bad. I make reference just in passing to an article someone just sent to me, a contemporary article, just came out very recently, about combining these two. That if in case a woman has an aguna situation of a yavam, as a brother-in-law who will not give a chalitza, well then she should enter into a pilegish kind of a relationship, which is highly problematic. If she's not allowed to marry, she shouldn't be allowed to become a pilegesh either. Any beer should be prohibited. They tried to make a case that lo siya eshta, I mean, it's only if it's isur kiddush. Quotes of Chaim Moshe said it's wrong. But there are those who argue. Now, the fact that there are those who argue, that's not enough. You can't have those who argue. They have to be, you know, of a certain level. It doesn't rise to that level. So that's not a solution in that particular case. In any event, some suggested that the marriages are probably kiddushei tos. It was a famous Bezdin about, I don't know, 8-10 years ago, had a whole manifesto that if the husband doesn't treat his wife properly, it's because he was a no good egg in the first place. So had she known when she married him that he was going to treat her that way, she never would have married him in the first place. Sounds like a Torah Sadora almost. Also this week's parsha. Everything else was, this is a long parsha, you say, so everything's there. But The fallacy with that, of course, is that it's simply factually not true. There are many situations of men who are okay guys, and then they go sour. And even if the underlying causes of their ultimate misbehavior were there, I'm sorry to say we all have underlying causes in our midst. We try to, they should never come out. I mean, everyone has latent problems. It's our goal in life, we should live till 120 years, and these problems should remain latent. They should never come out. So to then say that, well, since he had a latent problem before the marriage, I'm sorry, probably none of us would be married. But we all have latent problems that our respective wives didn't know about when we got married. We hope, Baruch Hashem, to be able to control ourselves and not let them come to the fore. But this is not really a solution in a cross-the-board situation. Maybe rare cases, or most of the few rare cases of Kiddush Etos, but it's almost impossible. Some say, what do you mean? I look in the Gemara. Afkinu rabbanan l'kiddushin minei. The rabbis have the power to undo kiddushin. So just by fiat, we'll say, we undo the kiddushin in the case where there would be a civil divorce. Almost all poskim say that no bezin today has the power to do such a thing. You can just say, boom, we knock out the kiddushin. It just doesn't work anymore. Don't have that ability. So that's... Some say, well, why don't you write a get on a condition before the marriage? Let's write in advance. A get on the condition. I marry her, and I write a get. In case of civil divorce, I'm divorcing you right now. The second, under the chuppah. Yeah. or I appoint a shliach under the chuppah to write the get in case it's going to be a civil divorce. All these cases are probably no good because the bia between the husband and the wife cancels the shlichos or cancels the get. So it doesn't really work. Some have this wild idea, a get zikui, which means that since it's good for him and for her that they should be divorced, so you can write the get for her without his consent. This is wild. This is not accepted by any responsible posek. I'm just mentioning a few of the wilder things because, you know, these things are out there as we speak. Let me focus now for the remainder of the shiur on a support agreement, which in fact might be helpful in some cases to alleviate the aguna problem. I want to recognize the contributions in this field of one of the very eminent Rosh Hashivas here in our yeshiva, Rabbi Bleich Shalita, was written extensively and has put forth a number of different solutions along these lines to help alleviate the aguna problem. And all of his solutions are remarkable and erudite. Unfortunately, for a variety of reasons, they haven't come into how should I say it, mass circulation. And Rabbi Bleich himself has written that he doesn't want to, they should be in mass circulation until they achieve consensus of many other rabbanim. This hasn't been enough push in this direction. So I want to tell you back to my involvement in this whole parasha. Flashback to 1990, we're learning Masechta Gittin. And I found in a publication called Moria. Moria is a very prestigious publication by Mechon Yerushalayim. Comes out, I think, a few times a year. There was a suggestion by a tremendous Talmud Chacham, Rabbi Zalman Nechemya Goldberg Shalita, Shlomo Zalman's son-in-law, along these lines. If the couple won't be living together for whatever reason, then the man agrees to support his wife X dollars a day, and perhaps this will solve some of the issues. So I remember when I saw this couple, this is printed, I think, in 1988. I saw it in 1990. I called up. I said, is anyone doing this? Is it in real life? No. I said, well, can we, is it okay with you if we try it? I said, fine. So I corresponded with him back and forth, certain emendations for the American scene, here and there. And one of his very close associates, who has actually printed the original article, Rabbi Gartner, who lives in Ramot. Finally, I went to Eretz Yisrael it was January of 91. It was the beginning of the Gulf War, if I remember when it was. Dodging the initial part of that war, and the Rav Zalman Nechemya says, listen, I can't do this on my own. You have to go to another colleague. Even though he was a great, great person, a dayan, go to Rav Tzimbalist in Tel Aviv. Rav Tzimbalist is also one of the greatest dayanim in Eretz Yisrael. He was once actually a Rebbe in this building. He taught in TI when he got married to an American woman, believe it or not. He was one of the Gedolei Hadar. So I went to see him, and he turned the whole thing upside down. But not the other way around. I said to myself, I'm finished. Rabbi, he wants this, he'll go nowhere. So, but I Zalman Nechemya Goldberg is a tremendous honor as well as a goyin and a tzaddik. He said, okay, we'll do it his way. So, I like that. So we'll do it his way. So that's the way we're doing it. Took another full year of back and forth to get the lawyers to agree and then the rabbanim to agree. Went back the following January and I got the signatures of these two gedolim, Rav Goldberg and Rav Tzimbalist. I wanted to get, because it's a big Sephardic population, I went to Rabbi Avadi Yosef, who also signed on. And here in this country, I received the signatures of Rav Schwartz Shalita, of the Bezdin of America, and L'Havdil Min Chayim L'Chayim, Rabbi Libes Zecher Tzadok Levracha, was a Rav in the Bronx for quite a number of years. Some of you may know him, the Mechaber Shut Beis Avi, and he's then living in Borough Park. So those five signed on to it. Frankly, I wanted some of it of a broader consensus, even if not to signatures, but to have other rabbanim, and we'll call the more Haredi community, to give some positive support to it. I did speak to a number of them, and they felt that, you know, maybe it's a good idea, but not going to happen in our world. That was their response. I'm not going into that. But on a halachic level, it was more or less approved. And this is how it goes. A man, as you see in the Gemara Masechta Ksubis, is able to accept upon himself an independent obligation of support. The case in the Gemara is he agrees to support a stepdaughter. So I can agree to support my stepdaughter as long as I'm married to my second wife. That's a binding obligation. So too, the argument went, you can agree to support your own wife as long as you're halachically married. In a separate and distinct obligation, which is not bound by the limitations of the chiyuv ksuba, which are, you know, enshrined in halacha and shulchan aruch. So you can do such a thing. Now, question is, if the obligation is exaggerated, it's a tremendous amount of money, which was suggested by a number of people. Rabbi Black suggested such a thing, and Rav Zsolti, Zichron Levracha, suggested such a thing, and others. It runs into a problem of being understood as what we call a penalty clause, a fine, a knas. And there are more rights, as you'll find over here in source number five. Ablam kibel alav knasos im lo yigareish lo mikre ones. Right, you accepted the knas upon yourself. Unfortunately, v'yesh machmir mafila b'chay gavne. Some say even if you accepted the knas on yourself, it's no good. V'tov lochosh lechatchila lepotro min haknas. Ablam kro girish v'pneze haget kosher hol mitchila lo ansu. So though according to Rambam, the get would be kosher post facto, we should not get involved in these situations in the first place. There were those who are more lenient than the Rambam, those who are more strict than the Rambam, but you don't want to get involved into such a penalty clause. So therefore the way to avoid a penalty clause is simply to make it a non-penalty clause. To make it a reasonable support agreement. It should be reasonable. Now of course, what is reasonable? How much does it cost to live? That's a difficult question to answer. How much does it cost a single person to live for a year today? Now, what expense must you tally? Obviously, it's food. Women's clothing for a year. Everyone has a credit card bill that they pay and knows what I'm talking about. That could be, you know, potentially quite staggering. There's, of course, living expense, a rental expense or something along those lines. In many cases, you have to have a car, you have to have health insurance, you know, you have to have the expenses at the cost, you know. Obviously, the biggest variable, I guess the biggest variable, where you're going to live. We know that to live in Park Avenue is one thing, to live in Riverdale is another thing, maybe to live in... I don't know, everything's expensive nowadays. I can't give an example of a Torah community where the price hasn't gone up recently. Anybody know one? Maybe we should all move there. No, the Heights? The Heights is extraordinarily expensive now. You will find out. Why are you housing? Okay, that's not an option for everybody. Anyway, so it costs a lot of money. And the person's entitled to live a decent standard of living. You're not required to live in poverty. So I'm asking you, what do you think it costs? What does it cost to live for a year? Calculating all these expenses and things which I haven't even thought of. Anybody want to suggest a figure? Throw out a ballpark figure? 50,000? I think that's correct. I think it's very correct. 50,000, that's what it costs. I mean, some people live along on 30, some people need 70. You have to pick some kind of an average figure. When we started this thing, this is in the early 90s, we had a sum of $100 a day, which translates to $36,000. A few years ago, we said that's just not enough for most people, so we upped it to $150 a day, which is a bit over $50,000, and, you know, it's going to move up. And then I guess another 10 years, we'll have to make maybe another adjustment. We'll see. So I don't think that's considered to be a gross exaggeration. You can argue it's too little, too much, but that's exactly the point. We're trying to make it a standard sum. Now, what is the trigger? What is the trigger for this obligation to kick in? So the trigger is at a time in which the couple is no longer living together. And the reason is it makes a lot of, this is a rather simplest idea, and it really goes back to the Nachlas Shiva Simen Tes. It's easy to find, Nachlas Shiva Simen Tes. And this Nachlas Shiva is actually quoted in the Shulchan Aruch. I'll show you in a moment. Let's see, can I show you in a moment? I'm afraid that I can't show you because they don't have the right maramakam here. But it says in today's Tanoim, for those who know, Rav Moshe came along and in effect emasculated the Tanoim. There's nothing there because they're going to get married. But the original Tanoim had a language as follows, which should have been on the Makaros. Umachmas idur uktat yomad kitakonas shum. Now, what does Idur mean? Those of you may know, it's a subis, that if a person would give all his money as a dowry to his daughter, and his daughter died within a year, so it's v'tam l'rikochachem, he had no money, he had no daughter, nebuch. So there was a clause that in case the daughter died within a year, the money would go back to him. That's called Idur. Idur is now, in modern Hebrew, if you're absent, you're called, you're nedar. This is a permanent absence. It's a euphemism for death. What's Ktat all about? What's this Ktat story? So Ktat means exactly so. You look in the Nachal Shiva Simites that in case of a fight, so and they're no longer living together. So the Bezdin says, if they're consulted, that the man has to give his wife, he accepts on himself before the marriage, to pay her a gold coin a week, or 10 gold coins, but we don't know what these coins really mean in today's world, until the Bezdin, the other euphemism, will solve the problem. The Bezdin problem, the MSWs will solve the problem, and they'll make restore Shalom Bayis, Halavai. What it really means is, that as long as they're living together, it's going to cost the money out of pocket every week. This is exactly the point. Nowhere is the word get mentioned in this, as long as they're married. And of course, obviously, if he gets divorced, he doesn't pay any money anymore. This is only as long as they're married. So this gives an incentive to a husband to give his wife a get when the Bezdin requires him to do so. And therefore, it seems to be a situation in which there is no penalty. It's a reasonable amount. And the husband's more likely to respond to a Bezdin. You're right, that's prenuptial. It's enforceable in secular court, in effect, based upon what the Bezdin said. And therefore, the person has to sort of face the music. There are a number of issues which I want to discuss up front. One is a very complex issue which is known as asmachta. You may have learned the sugya asmachta lo kanya. What is an asmachta? It's a matter of great dispute between the Rambam and the Balei HaTosfos. The Rambam says asmachta is a contingency obligation. Any obligation which is contingent is an asmachta lo kanya. Here is a classical case of an obligation on a contingency. So what do you do? How does it work? Going to the Rambam, how does it work? So the answer is the Rambam himself says that if it's done what we call me'akshav, a kinyan me'akshav, this overcomes the problem of asmachta. And therefore, this document has in it explicitly, there's a kinyan me'akshav, and this overcomes the asmachta according to the Rambam. Does it actually have to be a Kabbalah's kinyan? Not even. As long as you write in the document that you were mekabel kinyan, the poskim say, as long as you agree to it and you admit to it, that it's considered as if it happened, and therefore the obligation is binding. I have to be honest with you. The truth to tell is that it's possible the Rambam never said it. I happen to agree Rambam never said it. Because it's possible the Rambam only said that a chalipin me'achshav overcomes asmachta in the case of a asmachta transaction, a sale under asmachta, but not in the case of a conditional obligation. You're not selling an object, you're simply obligating yourself. This is would answer a lot of the questions of the Kesef Mishnah and the Magad Mishnah. It would make a lot of sense, and I believe it's probably true within the Rambam. However, the Shulchan Aruch, again based on a source not here, but in Hilchos Ari of Kuflam and Alf and Choshen Mishpat, clearly understood, consistent with his own explanation Beis Yosef and the Kesef Mishnah, that even a contingency obligation would be binding according to the Rambam if there's a kinyan me'achshav. And therefore, since we don't follow the Rambam, as I mentioned earlier in a different context, we follow the Shulchan Aruch, Sfardim, and even Ashkenazim up to a point. So this me'achshav, the chalipin would overcome asmachta according to Shitas HaShulchan Aruch. The Ramah, following the Balei HaTosfos, has a different definition of asmachta. It's a matter of an exaggerated obligation, guzma, based on the Bali Atosis. However, the Ramah himself has yet another way out of the Asmachta, which is based on the Sugi and Mesechta Nedarim, which is called a person is in the Kabbal on himself a Kinyan, Bebezdin Choshuv, in an esteemed or distinguished Bezdin. And this somehow, according to the Ramah and the Mitosis, overcomes the Asmachta problem. So in the prenuptial agreement that we have them both. We have the Kinyan, Me'achshav, Bebezdin Choshuv, everything's written in. Did it actually have to be in a Bezdin Choshuv? No. As long as you admit that it happened, it happened. Halachically, Hodoaz Baldin Kameidim Dami, the post can say in this context. I will mention that one of my conversations which I had with a great posek, I'll mention his name. His name is Harav HaGaon Rav Feivel Cohen Shlita. I asked him about this issue because he's a very preeminent posek, someone whom I knew. And I said, is there any asmachta problem here? And I came with, I asked him the question with a smile, because he has a beautiful sefer. It's called, I think it's called Midor Lador, about halakhic wills, financial wills, in which he advocates precisely such an obligation. In the case the one beneficiary will not follow the last will and testament, then the man, the person who will ultimately die in writing the will, obligates, indemnifies himself to the other beneficiaries, or whoever it may be, a staggering sum of money. Where it is a guzma, it is a tremendous amount, it is a contingency. But he writes in there to protect himself. It's a Kabbalah's Kinyan, Bebezdin Choshuv Me'achshav. So I knew that he's going to say it's not an asmachta. And he's, sure enough, he said it's not an asmachta, which he has in his own sefer. Interestingly, there was a case, this is a remarkable case, there was a case, a Shidduchim I made in heaven. There was a case in which the Kala was from the Hebrew Institute of Riverdale. Some of you may know who the Rabbi Hanshul is. And the Chosin was a Talmud in the Yeshiva Farakaway at the time that Rabbi Cohen Sunler, Rabbi Kaffer, now is in Waterbury, was the Rebbe, and he was in Messiah Kedusha. And the Kala said, my Rabbi won't let me get married unless I have a prenup. And he said, what is this? I don't know anything about this one. Even though Rabbi Peer, his own Rosh Hashiva, has his prenup, that's only for a Shtar Biruin, nothing more than that. So he ended up calling me. So I said, yes, but I don't think it's much of an asmachta problem. I said, but are there certain rabbanim who have certain objections? I said, yes. And I faxed Rabbi Cohen some of the objections to this prenup. Full disclosure of what the objections were. And after it was said and done, he allowed his son-in-law to proceed with the Siddur Kiddushin with the prenup. Now, this doesn't mean that in Brooklyn they're doing it on a regular basis. Unfortunately, they're suffering as a result. But I'm just telling you, this incident came to my mind that we assume it's not considered a problem of an asmachta. There is another technical problem, which is even if the husband agrees to obligate himself to support his wife, perhaps he's entitled to his wife's earnings. And that could be very considerable these days. So it's going to go out the window. We said $50,000 to support her. She's likely making more than that. So be a wash. So the husband writes in this prenup that he waives his rights, his halachic rights to his wife's earnings for the period that this particular obligation is in full force and effect. There's a question how you do that. Maybe you have to do it between Erisin and Nisuin. So we write that it shall be deemed as if he repeated this waiver at the time of the marriage. It's possible that the truth is that he would not be entitled to it anyway. It's what we call Hadofai de Hadchak, or even more that she's working beyond the typical easy work that was done by the women in yesteryear. They would just do a little bit of knitting in the house. She's a lawyer, a doctor, there's much more than that. Again, these are technicalities which are we try to work out to the best of possibility. There are those who claim, I'll end with this to give you a chance for some questions. There are those who say, well, it's not fair to the man because he's going to sign this piece of paper. And what will happen if the couple separates? And as of that moment, there is an obligation to pay money. And then she'll ask for the money when she's not entitled to it. So, of course, the document takes care of that by saying that if the husband comes to Beis Din and the wife refuses to either come or to follow the Beis Din, then the obligation is terminated. Period. So The issue is the baini. There could be a point in time when she'll try to pull a fast one. And she knows how to go to Bezin. They'll just work things out. And then she'll come, oh, you see, there was that much time between when you didn't support me, I want that money. So shtei tshuvos b'davar. Number one, maybe she's entitled to the money. If he wasn't paying her credit card bills when they were married and they were living apart, maybe she's entitled to it. Number two, this cannot be collected in a secular court without the absolute consent and approval and authorization of the Bezin. If the Bezin sees that it's some kind of a not fair play, they have the ability to set things right. I'll leave you some time for questions. These are some of the highlights. If you want to get a copy of this prenup, you can get it online through the Bezin of America, and I strongly encourage it to be filled out. I personally am not that strong. I will do a wedding without it, but I do recommend it. It's something which hopefully will just gather dust in a drawer, but it's a good thing that should exist. If nothing else, to save a person, the man, from his own worst instincts. I say, save the wife. You're saving yourself. Now that you're thinking sanely and now that you love each other, do this. Hopefully, it will never come to use. I'll take questions. Yes, sir.
Where does the concept of volunteer kapelos come
from? It comes in, but what does the Ksuba say? Ksuba says in case there will be a death or divorce, there's going to be money collected. That's what it says. Yes.
Does this require the same kind of aid as pursued by another person?
It would be better to have Aiden, but it seems to me as long as the man signs it, it's already binding. Although it's bound in his, by his signature, Ksav Yado would be good enough, Ksav Yado. And as a matter of fact, from the legal perspective, it's preferred to have witnesses, it's preferred to be notarized. One of our friends, I think it was Mark Stern, had passed a law in New York State that every rabbi who is authorized to perform a marriage in New York State is in effect a notary when it comes to this limited type of a document. So that's another plus. Yes, sir.
Without agent, so it's scraps out yada, so it could not affect the lien on any property that he sold or disposed of. But if it has witnesses, then he would be able to have.
That's true. That's in halachic terms. In legal terms, I'm not sure if that's the lawyer. Yes?
Has it gone through the entire process any number of times?
In courts?
No, this pretty
much. It's used all the time. There are thousands of them out there. You wonder that it was a challenge in court. That's the question. Unfortunately, out of the thousands out there, the law of statistics has proved to be true. There have been numerous cases. Rabbi Reis of Mabezin pointed out that he was going through some files. He saw that in the last year, unfortunately, there were it was a double-digit number. It was 10, 11, 12, something like that, of cases where there was this prenup, and in all cases, it was given in a timely fashion. Yes?
The prenup is not a case for inflation.
Inflation? Yes, there's a CPI in there. Yeah. Yes?
Do you suggest that
usurious mortgage
continues as long as
it continues. The Bezin is open to suggestions. This is not the Aseres HaDibros, which can't be touched. We've made changes, and we may actually make another change. It was a recent case someone started writing to within the Jewish press. That's all kinds of things. He had misunderstood it. And to clear up his misunderstanding, he made actually an extra word, which will make it as clear as day, that this can only be collected in court with the Bezin's involvement. So people somehow didn't read it that way, but yes.
Do you apply the rule of Ola Imo and Eredis Imo? The husband's very wealthy to set a higher amount of money, even if she could get along with less.
That's true in terms of Chiyuv Iksuba, but it's true in terms of this particular document. We try to keep it at a standard amount. If you wanted to increase a little bit because
of the husband, I'm asking if the husband is like, I won't say Donald Trump, but very, very, very wealthy, then maybe $50,000 a year means nothing to him.
So right.
Oh, man, I don't care.
This remedy will not work for the very wealthy or for the very poor. The very wealthy, they'll pay it, it's meaningless. The very poor say, I have it. But many people in this room are neither very wealthy or very poor, so it works for most of us. Have a good day.